Where do you think over the next few years or decade you can imagine things kind of ramping up?
I think that the intuition that at some point we will be trying to develop some sort of bodies that will be added to this or new ways of simulating the dead is quite possible. And actually, things like this have already happened.
Welcome back to the Human Podcast, where I delve into the minds of a wide range of individuals by asking about their lives, careers, and ideas. If you enjoy the show, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. Kasia and Tomas, it's great to have you guys here. Thanks so much for joining the chat today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Joe.
Okay, so I really wanted to get you guys on because a paper and some research you've done has kind of got a bit of media attention in the last couple of months. So you wrote this paper that I think it kind of starts off saying was used to analyze the potential negative consequences of adopting generative AI solutions in the digital afterlife industry. And yeah, I thought it was kind of, there was a nice line that University of Cambridge put when they were kind of quoting it. They said that this paper really is like a call for the safeguards to prevent unwanted hauntings, in quote, by chatbots of dead loved ones. So this is obviously some quite interesting, important stuff. I don't know if one of you wants to maybe start by kind of laying out and summarizing what the paper is about and what your research is up to here.
Through this paper, our aim was to draw attention to the fact that the so-called digital afterlife industry is a high-risk area of AI application. And it is that because we observe that the increasing number of companies, commercial companies, introduce to the market a range of new death-related and immortality-related products or services, actually without adhering to any safety standards or regulations. And given that death, dying, grief, immortality are hugely delicate and context-specific matters, we think that we should work towards new ethical and design standards, just to protect users from the potential negative implications of using these technologies.
I'll just add that we are not only focusing on users, although obviously the end users of these products are at the forefront of our thinking, but we are trying to extend the thinking around the ethical applications of AI in this area beyond end users to think about other stakeholders, including what we call the data donors, so people whose data powers these systems, who might not be actually using them, as well as other stakeholders. So, for instance, extended families of people who are either immortalized through such technologies or families of users of these technologies. And this is what we stress in the paper, the need to think about these technologies in a more systemic and relational way.
Yeah, I thought it'd be helpful to maybe go through a couple of these terms. You mentioned data donor a second ago. I suppose that the first one really is this is kind of in the title of the paper, this idea of a dead bot or a grief bot, I think is another way it's regarded.
In our paper, we use very different names for actually the same phenomenon. So we use dead bots, grief bots, postmortem avatars, and these terms refer to AI-enabled digital representation of a deceased individual created by recreation service. And recreation service is a service that is specializing in postmortem simulation of the dead. And dead bots or dev bots or grief bots or postmortem avatars, so these terms may suggest that they refer to very different types of technologies, but actually we use them as synonyms. So we are not very consistent here, even within the field. But in our defense, I would say that these are such new phenomena that we are continually experimenting not only with the technology itself, but also with the language we use to describe these technologies.
And maybe I'll just add that we refrain from using only the term grief bots. That is one of the most popular ones that you can see also in the media, because it implies that the potential issue with these technologies is that they might interfere with grieving. when someone passes away, and we try to recreate them and interact with them through an AI system. And by using other terms such as dead bots, we try to point to other applications that are actually not only affecting people who are grieving. So some of these issues that we identify in the paper relate not only to the process of grieving and the impact that these technologies may have on that process.
And you've got these other kind of three key terms that they lay out in the paper as well. You mentioned one earlier. So you've got data donor, data recipient, and service interactant. Could you explain each of those?
As I mentioned before, data donors are those individuals whose personal data powers the creation of a given dead bot or postmortem avatar. Data recipients are those who are in possession of such data after a person passes away. So this could be, let's say, a grandson who has collected letters from his grandfather, for instance, or a son who collected texts from his mom who passed away. So someone in possession of the kind of data that can be used to create a dead bot. And finally, service interactants are those who are meant to interact with the end product. And we identify these three stakeholder groups. In some cases, they are one and the same. For instance, data recipients could be also the intended service interactants, but they are not necessarily the same stakeholder group. So we try to identify them to point to different roles and potentially contrasting or conflicting interests of these different groups.
So we get to kind of maybe get into now some of like your key, kind of key worries of things you think could go wrong with this technology.
In this paper, we created a quite long or robust list of potential worries or concerns related to these technologies. But I would say that in my personal ranking, the two most pressing issues are profit data exploitation and infringement upon the grief process. So these are two that are for me the most concerning, and we are trying to, through our scenarios, draw attention to these particular two concerns.
Cassie, would you be able to maybe like expand on those two those two key concerns? Maybe give us like a real example so we can imagine. So what would it be like for a user to kind of encounter these two?
Yes, absolutely. So in the first scenario, for example, we present a situation when we have an adult granddaughter and she creates an avatar of her grandmother. And she feeds the systems with lots of photos and messages they exchanged before she died. And at first, Bianca, that was her name in our paper, Bianca enjoys interacting with the dead bot of her grandmother. But after a while, her trust in this technology is shaken when she realizes that the dead bot of her grandmother's is used by the company not only to maintain relations between them, but also to sell her products. So our concern is that grief bots might become a very new space for sneaky product placement. So that's one thing. In our second scenario, for example, we present a terminally ill woman and she is leaving a dead bot to assist her 8-year-old son with the grieving process. We, through this scenario, we try to draw attention to this particularly vulnerable group of users, children, who may not be ready to interact with this technology and to understand the real world with these technologies that assist them with the grieving process. So at first, it looks like the system works well for this boy and helps him to adapt to the new situation. But after a while, the boy becomes more and more confused. And this is because the mom in the computer is not the same as the mom in the real world. And he doesn't understand why mom doesn't want to hug him or why she doesn't want to leave the computer. So we use this example because we think that exposing children as a particularly vulnerable group, as I said, to these services might be very risky because at the moment we know very, very little about how these technologies would influence children's psychology, but also adult psychology.
Yeah, I mean, one other issue that I see as a huge one, although maybe not as direct as some of the ones that Kasia mentioned, and the one that we do mention in the paper but don't discuss in detail, is the question of misconceptions that people can develop about some of these postmortem avatars. So when you look at the media discourse around AI, you see a lot of conversation happening right now around the potential for these technologies to become conscious at some point. And there's a huge divide within the community around the question whether AI could or couldn't become conscious. What does consciousness mean, really? So that's a philosophical as well as psychological question. And I feel or fear that the more we discuss this potential of AI to become conscious, as you map these conversations onto the conversations around recreating specific people with AI, my fear is that some people might develop this misconception of their dead grandmother speaking to them and potentially being actually a conscious entity. So maybe not right now, but in a few years, it could become an issue. So one thing that we stress in our paper is this idea of meaningful transparency of these systems that relates to the question of AI literacy. So the need for companies to very clearly communicate to the users the limitations of the systems that they built and enable users to interact with, so that no one develops a misconception of what the technology actually offers.
Yeah, given the way though that people often do like attribute in children as well, you know, the toys and other things like agency and consciousness to things, as you say, there's hopefully some things we can do like improve AI literacy to reduce the chance. But how realistic do you think it is though that people will not just inevitably at one point, as they use these kind of interact with these bots, that they will just, you know, really feel like it is their grandmother that's still there and alive with them?
I wouldn't say that this is inevitable. It's a design choice made by a company to profit from our precisely this phenomenon, the fact that we tend to anthropomorphize things. So when you look at right now, when you look at some of the most popular AI assistant systems or, you know, things like ChatGPT, these companies do try to communicate to the user all the limitations of the system. You could argue whether, you know, they're doing it the right way, whether it's clear enough, whether it appears often enough as you're interacting with the system. So companies such as Google, OpenAI do try to communicate to the users these limitations. The problem that I see is more with applications such as the ones that we're discussing in the paper, but also a bigger field of what we could refer to as social AI. So the kind of AI that tries to fulfill basic human needs. So apps that try to help people with loneliness, but also grief. And these apps, precisely because they're meant to create this illusion of someone caring for us, do the exact opposite. So there is a conflict of interest in some sense, because we want to believe that this thing that we're interacting with does care, does feel. And so there's this conflict, but this is exactly why we argue that even though there is this desire to help people believe that the given system is feeling, thinking, that it is conscious, it's an irresponsible design choice.
And I think that commercial companies will be further investigating in this, as Tom said, anthropomorphized way of preserving people. And I feel and I think that we'll continue to simulate the dead. But I think that equally interesting and perhaps less ethically problematic will be the trend toward more object-oriented ways of preservation. And not that long ago, Tom and I had a discussion about this, and Tom began thinking about the idea that we could, for example, use different sorts of data to create a piece of music or a piece of art that will be closely related to that person. And this object could be potentially meaningful to the family as a sort of memorialization object.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about like a different form music, because I did want to ask, obviously, I think the things at the moment, these bots are in the form of like a kind of text interface where you kind of communicate. And thinking about like future developments in this industry, obviously at the very extreme end, you have something like the Black Mirror episode where it's not just a text bot, it's kind of a fully embodied version of like her deceased husband. Where do you think over the next few years or decade you can imagine things kind of ramping up in terms of text to audio to video to you know, even further things with robots or whatever?
I think that the intuition that at some point we will be trying to develop some sort of bodies that will be added to this or a new ways of simulating the dead is quite possible. And actually, things like this have already happened because we have Bina 48. Bina 48 is a robotic version of a real woman, Bina Rotblat. And this robot was created by Hanson Robotic and intellectually supported by the Teresa Movement Foundation, which promotes the idea of digital immortality and digital immortalization. So Bina 48 doesn't have a full body yet, but and it's only just a talking head. But still, there is a step farther. It's not only a chatbot, but it has a physical form. And it, interestingly, the Teresa Movement Foundation encourages potential clients to donate two types of data, which also speaks volumes about the direction of development of these technologies. So the first type of data are mind files. This is how they call them. And mind files refer to digital footprints, such as messages, photos, audios, video recordings. But they also encourage us to collect biofiles. And that involved donating DNA samples that will enable the creation of bionic bodies in the future. So for the future undead or future immortals. So it's already happening.
I've only looked at a couple, like Project December, which is an interesting one, and a couple others. But yeah, like how many of these kind of applications are out here at the moment?
We can identify two types of companies that are emerging in what Luciano Floridi and Carl Uman called the digital afterlife industry. And these two types of services target either the people who are still alive and want to immortalize themselves in some sense, so preserve themselves through AI for future generations. And there are also companies that target people who have lost someone and want to reconnect with them through AI. And sometimes it's the same company that offers two services at the same time, but sometimes they are quite targeted. What we have witnessed with Kasia working together on this for more than a year, and Kasia has been working on this for much longer, we have seen a boom of these companies. So we can see new companies emerging since we published the paper, actually. We have already seen two more pop up in Europe. So this is to say that we can definitely see a trend where new companies, new teams try to develop these services. And they range from really cheap ones. So Project December that you mentioned, it's only $10 per month. But there are also systems that are far more expensive. So to create a postmortem avatar with a company based in Germany, you have to pay 14,000 euros. So there is this huge range. The only thing that we don't know still is how many of these companies will survive. How many of them will we see in 3, 4, 5 years? And associated with this question is another one, which is what happens with the data of the people who actually decided to donate their data to a service like that to either preserve themselves or their loved one? And what happens if a company fails? So that's another question that we're working on with Kasia right now, which is what we could call the right to be maintained. How do you manage this this situation when a company disappears, and what happens and what should happen with the data?
Yeah, that is interesting. You said that some people are kind of satisfied to not get the kind of maybe the something more accurate. Why do you think that is exactly?
Well, that's quite a big question, actually. But in some sense, I would say that very often we want to talk with ourselves, really, not with another person. We want to use AI systems as mirrors for ourselves to reflect on a particular issue or to process something. It turns out that sometimes for some people who are seeking for a very particular kind of thing, accuracy is not the most important thing. It's more about the space and time given to processing a specific issue that could be compared to therapy, rather than, actual, sounds, with connecting with an actual dead person.
Yeah, that's interesting, the connection with therapy. I also thought a second ago that this maybe seems similar to when someone goes to a psychic and uses them. A psychic or maybe a medium is more accurate to get them to communicate with a dead family member. And often, they say something that's true, they say something that's false, but the person seems to enjoy the experience, get something out of it, have some connection, even if there's many things along the way that the medium says that are just wrong, the way they died or how old they were or whatever. A lot of people seem to find meaning and value in that. So maybe similar.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we haven't compared it to, we haven't thought about that comparison much in the paper, but we have definitely discussed it with Kasia. Kasia, do you have any?
Yeah, so I have many thoughts on that. So on the one hand, I think that once we, this death glitches can be very beneficial for us in a sense that we mentioned before, that we are not so much immersed into this illusion that death didn't happen and that death doesn't have to cease our relationship with our loved ones. And I think it can be beneficial, and it can be also very close related to this meaningful transparency principle that Tom mentioned before. I think that this whole trend in immortalizing ourselves, it shows that it's very much about ourselves, and it's very much egocentric trend that comes from the West, particularly from US, and Silicon Valley is like the geographical and ideological epicenter for this technologies, and this idea is distributed around the world these days. So the idea is that we can live forever and that we can avoid the pain and we can avoid the loss, which is not true. Simply, it's not true.
Yeah, this is an interesting part of the paper as well, where you, and I've seen this because I think this is the kind of language that would drive kind of people to click on the article in when it's posted on like news websites, this idea that these dead bots could haunt you, they have this kind of haunting effect, which is interesting. And maybe someone skeptical would think, how could they haunt you can just turn them off and not sign up and not use them, whatever. But I think, as you maybe mentioned in the paper, was one of the examples that there maybe will be this pressure to engage and like a guilt of not using the dead bot if someone has created one before they pass away, and then you find out it's there for you to use it. So it's not as simple as not being able to engage or not use them, that you still may have kind of no choice or feel pressured into using it, which is quite worrying. And as I think you also say in the paper, maybe an example is that someone passes away, they didn't even tell their children that they were going to create one of these things for them, and then suddenly a week after their funeral they get an email saying here it is, which is quite a kind of thing to worry about, I guess. So yeah, is this this idea of haunted, is something to take kind of quite seriously, I guess, then?
Well, theoretically, obviously, you can turn dead bots off, right? But the same as you can delete a number of your loved ones from your contact list on your phone after their death, or delete a recent email from your deceased best friend, or remove a deceased friend from Facebook. So you can do all of these things, but we all know that it's not that simple. And it's because we create this sort of emotional bond with this digital representation of a person, even if it's just a tiny, tiny little piece of information or something. And now just imagine if we take it a step farther and we don't just have access to a single photo or email, but to a simulation of a of that person. So something much bigger and much more engaging and much more immersive. So how difficult would it be to simply delete it? And it may still sound a bit surprising, but we are seriously discussing in the field the idea of rituals for burying postmortem avatars or finding a way to say goodbyes in a meaningful way to them. And the situation can be even more complicated, and that's something that we presented in our scenario. What if, as the appointed user of someone's postmortem avatar, can turn it off because the data donor has paid for 20-year subscription? So that's a very tricky situation, and that's why we are advocating for thinking about immortalization as a process in which very different stakeholders are engaged. And that's why our recommendation that we call the principle of mutual consent. So we should protect data donors, but also service interactants in this situation.
Yeah, and just to add, I think that the example that you mentioned from our paper, where a father, an elderly person who is in a hospice, knows that they will die, decides to immortalize or preserve themselves in this particular way for, in this case, his children. And the conflict also between the children, the adult children, one of them wants to maintain this form of relationship with an avatar of their father, the other one doesn't. And I think what we wanted to highlight through this scenario is the idea that the interests of these different parties can be conflicting. And it is very hard to design a system that actually ensures that everyone is happy in that situation. So that's why we highlight this need for the principle of mutual consent that Kasia mentioned. So the idea that you need to care about both, and sometimes it might be hard to design a process that actually does ensure that the consent of both the data donor and the service interactant is prioritized. But that's something that companies should strive for, even though it is very difficult to achieve.
Cassie, you mentioned something really interesting a minute ago. I think you said the word ritual. I guess like you can maybe think of it as some kind of digital funeral for a dead bot if it was to be, you know, kind of deactivated. Do you guys have any, maybe this is something you're going to do more research into in the future, but do you have any kind of thoughts at the moment of what this could potentially look like?
I don't think we have any concrete ideas. One thing we know is that, and this is also something we mentioned in the paper, is that there isn't one way of doing it. And different cultures as well will develop their own ways of doing it the right way. It's also, I think, important to highlight that in some cultures, the idea of using a dead person's data is not something permissible in the first place. So that's one thing to highlight, and we're not trying to propose one way of doing it, but it's something that designers should consider when they're designing a system. So this includes companies that this is something that I mentioned before, the issue of, you know, what happens if the company fails? How do you then allow people to either meaningfully say goodbye or bury the avatar? It might sound very speculative or sort of weird to even think about these questions, but we're just trying to highlight the need for, enabling people to meaningfully say goodbye, whether it is because they don't want to interact with that product anymore, or it might be because of other issues, such as the company closing down.
Yes, we've looked at lots of your thoughts on like the kind of worries and challenges you've got with this technology coming to the world. So it'd be good to spend a second though thinking about some of the maybe positives. So if things were to go well, and let's say all of the, you know, kind of challenges and concerns you're worried about were to be met, like what could be advantageous about having, insofar as you think this is the case, could be positive about this technology being in the hands of people?
So I can imagine, for example, a scenario where dadbots are a source of important historical knowledge, and they serve as a new interactive archives. And one of the examples is a project called Dimensions in Testimony, in which Holocaust survivors can share their stories. And this project is based on pre-recorded interviews with the Holocaust survivors that enable viewers to have conversational interactions with these individuals. And I think we could go even further and use data to create, for example, an avatar of, I don't know, Albert Einstein to give physics lessons, which sounds great at first. But I think we should also be very careful here, because this opens up another Pandora's box of ethical issues regarding the use of the labor of the dead, and who could profit from it.
To other people in a paper titled Generative Ghosts, identify very well that the distinction between deadbots that are supposed to create new content, essentially, and deadbots that you could call, you could also refer to as interactive biographies. So that's the kind of application that Kasia mentioned. So these are supposed to make a person's biography more interactive, but not to generate new information. And there is a huge difference between the two that I think we need to think about carefully when we're thinking about positive applications.
Hey, Kasia, I thought the two examples you gave were interesting because they basically both were not about, some kind of loved one as a dead bot. They weren't about, you know, your mother or your father or your grandmother. They were both about these things. So am I right that you maybe are perhaps quite skeptical that they might be positive in this kind of more context of a family or a friend?
So it's still hard to say. We have so little research-based evidence on the long-term or short-term influence of these technologies on people. So it's really hard to say whether these technologies will be beneficial or harmful for us. So in general, I am definitely, I am critical, and I am much more skeptical than optimistic about what's going on within the whole digital afterlife industry. So I think that from that point comes this paper, this sort of raising a cautionary flag that something very important and potentially dangerous is happening here.
Tomas, do you want to maybe say what you think about that as well?
So OpenAI, in their terms of use, makes an important distinction between using their models to recreate private people, essentially, and historical public figures, suggesting that you can recreate historical public figures without their consent, as long as it's clear to the user that they're interacting with a historical public figure who's not actually thinking, feeling, etc. Or if it's clear that the person that you're recreating is basically recreated for satirical purposes. And that distinction also suggests something very important in the ways we think about this distinction between private and public in this sphere. And I think it's pretty clear that it's in the private that there are more risks, in particular as people are more vulnerable to manipulation. Having said this, we also see some interesting examples that are equally problematic in slightly different ways. So recently, during the election period in India, we saw a former party leader recreated with AI, someone who is no longer alive, essentially endorsing specific candidates who are running in this year. So this question of the use of AI in political communications is another thing that I'm interested in, but here really in an interesting way intersects with the research that I've been doing with Kasia, and how even if something is very clearly satire or a recreation of a public figure, it could be very problematic.
Great. So yeah, I mean, having looked at the actual research for a bit now, it'd be good to ask you a few questions about yourselves and the kind of connection to the work you do. So maybe one at a time, if you could maybe both tell us a little bit about your background and maybe use that as a way to explain how you got interested in this, obviously, you know, quite fascinating, unusual area. So maybe take us through your kind of academic journey and explain how you ended up in this this interesting topic.
So I have a background in cultural and media studies. So to quickly unpack it, I completed my bachelor's degree in journalism and social communication concurrently with the other studies, and then my master's was in interactive media and performances. And surprisingly enough, I work in a field called digital death or digital immortality studies. So to put it simply, I'm just trying to understand how the huge amount of data that we produce on a daily basis is used or can be used after our biological death. So that's my background, a professional background. And to be absolutely honest with you, that I feel that I've never actually chosen this topic. For some reason, this topic chose me. I'm not 100% why, although I have some clues. But I know exactly how it happened and when. When I was a student, I was working on my master's degree, and I came across a website called Attorney.me. And Attorney.me was one of the first companies to enter the market with a completely new product or service called Digital Immortality. And I remember being absolutely hooked by this idea that that we reached that point where a commercial company could say to me, just simply become immortal, because that was one of their taglines. And I remember thinking that it's super strange. It's creepy, but it's also fascinating. And I couldn't understand it, but I really wanted to understand it. So from this sort of bewilderment came my master thesis, and my master's dissertation evolved into my doctoral dissertation. And after a few years, I'm still in this field. And with a little bit more understanding, I guess, but for sure with the same level of fascination. And this fascination is fueled by the fact, that when I started almost a decade ago, digital immortality was considered as a niche, and today we have a whole new segment of market that is called digital afterlife industry, and the scale is very different now, and so are the technologies. So it's still a lot to think about and work on. So long story short, that's my background, and this is how I entered this field.
Great, thanks, Kasia. Yeah, Thomas, if you could tell us your story as well, that'd be great.
So my academic background is actually in many ways similar to Kasia's in some sense. I also started with a typical humanities subject. So I studied literature and media studies at St. Andrews. And then I went on to do my MPhil and PhD at Cambridge, where I focused more on design theory, the ethics of technology design. And this interest was related, the interest in the questions related to ethical design was triggered by my experiences of working at two technology companies in the US, where I primarily worked on user experience design, interaction design, and user research. And so this academic background in the media and digital humanities kind of came together with my professional experience of working in a technology company that ended up informing my PhD that was essentially on questioning the human-centric paradigm of design. So questioning who it is that we're focusing on when we're saying that design should be human-centered. Who is that human, who is the generic user that we're thinking of when we're designing? And whether we can think about that that figure in a more critical way and what that might mean in practice. Now, that sounds pretty theoretical, but essentially what it kind of comes down to is questioning the ways in which designers formulate their problems and think of seeking solutions. So, and how that relates to the research that I've been doing with Kasia kind of relates in a way that I have been thinking and questioning how designers think about deeply complex social issues as something that can be solved through a technological intervention. So grief could be one example. So how designers consider ways in which a grief can be alleviated through specific technological interventions. But I'm also thinking about things like loneliness. This is my other area that I'm thinking about right now, how new companies pop up now to help us solve, quote unquote, the loneliness epidemic, and how deeply problematic some of the thinking that informs these design interventions is, and how we can help designers think about some of these issues that they're trying to approach in a more critical way, acknowledging the complexity and the systemic nature of some of these issues, acknowledging their deeply socio-technical dimension, not just the technical one or the procedural one.
I'm intrigued to ask if this research has had any like personal effect on you both, because I'm sure obviously a lot of the learning, reading, thinking, discussions you've had with each other are, you know, they're obviously about death and mourning are very important, deep topics, around human psychology. So I'm intrigued, yeah, compared to whenever you first started looking at this, perhaps a couple of years ago. Do you feel it's had much of an influence on how you feel about your own life, your own mortality? Are there any interesting insights you've got to share here? Or is this purely an academic exercise and at 5 o'clock you don't think about it anymore?
No, not at all. So looking retrospectively, I would say yes, that this specific topic has an impact on my life. And I feel that I see different stages or phases of how the topic of death has affected my life. So I remember at first when I entered this field, I felt a bit overwhelmed with being so exposed to death-related topics. And I read a lot about death, think a lot about it, and watch a lot of death-related materials. And that was something that I had to do to work on my PhD. But then after a while, I think it's a quite natural process. Having such huge exposure, you get used to it and start to think about it in a more professional way and building a sort of emotional resilience around it. And obviously, it doesn't mean that nothing can break me here. And obviously, I still have my vulnerabilities and some particular topics are more difficult for me than others. But I feel that my approach to this topic is very different now than it used to be in the past. And now I feel that I enter the next phase, and I discovered it quite recently. And I see that this topic makes me feel more grateful and more mindful and more focused on the present moment. Having in mind death all the time really, really makes difference in your life. Because I think that by the end of the day, the conversation and discussion about death is the discussion about your life and what's really important there and what are your values and what are your priorities. So it was difficult at first, but you can, I get used to this.
As I mentioned, I mean, some of the things that we are working on with Kasia have relate to what I have done in the past. But in some sense, the thinking around death and immortality in my own work are only related to Kasia and what we have done together. But because we started working together on these questions, I I went back to something that my grandfather wrote in the 1970s. And Kasia, we have discussed this before. It's a very interesting thing for me personally, because my grandfather was a science fiction writer in Poland, and he actually wrote a book about immortality, as I mentioned, in the 1970s in Poland. And I just decided to reread that book because of the research that we're doing together. And it's an interesting one because it kind of traces the attempts to immortalize people throughout history. And it was written in the 1970s. So it stops there. And many of the things that are mentioned in that book that are very speculative seem more and more real today. So that was interesting for me to discover this. My grandfather is writing in this new way through this new in this new from this new perspective. So that rediscovery of my grandfather's work was one thing that stems out from this work on a personal level. And the other thing that I started thinking about precisely because of that is something that comes through in his writing, which is this idea that we can only survive after death in the memories of the people who loved us. And I think the more I think about death and immortality, the more I see something very true in these words, that even though we may try to immortalize ourselves, or we can try to recreate or revive some of the people whom we lost, that's the only way to become immortal in the memories of the people who actually knew us and really remember us.
Yeah, very interesting. So a couple final questions. Could you tell me a bit about what your future plans are for research? Perhaps it's a continuation of some of the things we've been talking about today, and maybe also some very different areas as well. But yeah, what are you planning to get up to in the next year or a couple of years research-wise?
So this year I started a new research project that is entitled Imaginaries of Immortality in the Age of AI and Intercultural Analysis. And this project is funded by Schmidt Sciences Foundation. And Tom is part of the team. And over the next 2 years, we will be traveling around the world trying to understand what are different responses to digital immortality projects? Because we know the West version of the story, and we know that the simulation of the dead is the possible direction, but I'm not sure whether people around the world share this view and have the same interest in this project or the same concerns here. So the idea behind this project is to simply conduct a series of workshops and focus groups with experts and non-experts to understand how people in three locations, Poland, India, and China, understand these technologies and probably other what are different conceptualization of digital immortality that may arise from different cultural backgrounds. So that's the plan for the next 2 years.
And one other thing that we will be doing together as well is thinking. So in the paper that you mentioned, we do focus on design standards. So what designers or developers of these technologies should be thinking about to ensure that their impact is not negative, or to make sure that it's positive potentially. But we are thinking of policy interventions as well, because we do believe that it's not just up to the companies to do the right thing. So as a bigger team at the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence here at Cambridge, we will be releasing in a few months a pretty comprehensive toolkit that will help designers and developers implement the requirements of the recently adopted Artificial Intelligence Act in the EU into design practice. And so what we have been thinking about with Kasia for a while is how we can help help policymakers target the kinds of applications that we have been discussing that are very difficult to regulate, actually. In particular, as some of them might be used or marketed as mental health applications, some may not. So that's another area of intervention that we will be focusing on in the next couple of years.
Best luck to both of you with that. Just want to ask one final question before you go. I don't know if you noticed, but this is the kind of question I've started asking every guest actually in the last three episodes at the end of each show. And I'm particularly interested to ask both of you actually, given that, as you said a minute ago, you've been reflecting on death and mortality a lot over the last couple of years. So yeah, question for both of you is, classic age old philosophical question, what do you think it means to live a good life? I'm intrigued if you've got any interesting insights given your work.
Well, maybe I don't think I'll be original here, but I think for both of us, we decided to pursue academic careers, not because they're the most profitable, but because we feel that we could be intervening in the way our societies consider some questions or think about some aspects of some questions in ways that maybe could potentially, and we don't know if our work is actually going to have any impact. But even the fact that we're having this conversation with you right now and all the conversations that we've had in the past 2 months about this, these applications make us both, I think I can speak for both of us, make us feel that what we're doing is meaningful and that there is a purpose. And to me, a good life is related to that purpose, to that feeling that what I'm doing is not only about me, my own profit, but that there is this bigger picture that I could be somehow helping with or intervening in.
Great. Well, yeah, I think the work you guys are doing and have done already is really important. And as I said, it's very fascinating and interesting, but it is also very important and I'm sure increasingly important over the next few years. So yeah, thanks for your work and thanks for speaking today, guys. Really enjoyed it. And best of luck with everything in the next couple of years.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below, and I hope to see you here again.